You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
I'm delighted to have with me another speaker, actually, from the Maxim Institute. You'll recall I had Dr. Stephanie Warboys on a few weeks back, but I was very, very conscious of the work done by Marianne Spurtle around the space of education. And as listeners, again, a little bit of a hint from me, my wife is very efficacious or very effective in this area. She has followed Marianne's work, listened to the podcasts. I think you had an open mic night that was recorded as well, or was. And so Rachel's been talking to me about Marianne's work, and I got to bump into her last week. So Marianne, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Simon. Great to be here.
Yeah, well, as I say, my wife has spoken incredibly highly of your work. So I've gone and read your report, and so you've done a few other online commentaries on it. And it's around the nature of New Zealand's curriculum. But before I jump into that, listeners would probably want to know, who is Marianne Spurtle? What's your background, your interest and expertise into this area?
Well, my background is not in teaching, actually. I studied journalism. I worked in communications. I've done a lot of work in the nonprofit space. And along the way, I've been involved with Maxim Institute. I studied public policy at Auckland Uni a few years back. And then last year, I started full-time as a researcher here in the field of education. So it's been a learning curve for me, and I've got huge respect for people like your wife who are on the ground with the kids every day.
Yeah, well, she's there at the moment as I sit here enjoying the life of a radio host. Marianne, you've got a master's from Auckland University in public policy, I see. Yeah. And I noted from your profile, you've also got a Bachelor of Arts in Communications from the California State University at Fullerton. But where is Fullerton? I haven't jumped onto Google yet.
Fullerton is in Orange County, where I lived for about 15 years.
Well, fantastic.
West Coast.
But now, I have sadly not been to Orange County, although I'm aware of it. There's so many TV shows which seem to come out of that area.
And yeah. Disneyland. The uni is close to Disneyland. But yeah, I was born in New Zealand and, of course, ended up back here because it doesn't compare to here.
Well, I think not dragging us into American politics, I'm actually chatting with my friend Bruce. He's on the other coast. He's on the East Coast in Maryland. We get all the political gossip, and this year's going to be pretty full on. But our focus, of course, is your recent research. So in September last year, you published Grading Our Curriculum, Failing Students, Teachers, and the Evidence Test. So quite an important piece of research, I would argue. But talk our listeners through... What are you talking about? What did you find? What are some of your key insights?
Well, the curriculum itself was released in 2007. It's been implemented since 2008. So it's a little bit dated now. And from early on, people were identifying problems with it. Just to summarize how it works, it is heavily focused on five key competencies, as they're called. And to give you an example, three of them are thinking, relating to others, and using language. And then learning areas, which we call subject areas, are kind of secondary to that. So the focus is very much on being able to do things. Knowledge takes a back seat. What you know is less important to, you know, this brand new knowledge economy that they were picturing in the early 2000s. Being able to do stuff, put things into practice. The problem with that is you can think, relate to others, and use language perfectly well without going to school. Like, those are things that we develop naturally as humans. So there's a lot of emphasis on things that actually aren't explicitly teachable. And the subject matter went from 60, 80, sometimes over 100 pages for a subject area for a year. The curriculum material for teachers has gone to a single A4, double-sided. So that gives you an idea of how much direction teachers have been getting. And this is since 2008. This is what teachers have had to work with from the Ministry of Education. Now, the advantage of that is that you can pretty much inject anything you like into the curriculum, and schools have a bit of autonomy that way. The downside is you don't have explicitly staged content material by subject, by year. And so if you've got a teacher who's not trained in curriculum design, which more than half aren't because they're teachers, they're not curriculum designers, there could be a deficit there. If you've got a teacher who doesn't know much about the subject area they're teaching, you're going to have a deficit there. So you've got this great variance in quality of education because it's so sparse. That's one of the problems.
Well, let's tease a bit of that out, because I think if I've understood you correctly, well, I think back, because I'm old enough to say this, when I was at school, not as a teacher or studying the curriculum, but we had textbooks, and it was very clear that teachers were drawing on a body or a corpus of knowledge that they were then imparting across. It was very structured, for want of a better word, and I probably have the nomenclature or the terms wrong, so correct me, but they had an extensive knowledge base that didn't have to be their own, is my sense, which they were then able to hand across. But you're saying in 2007, or rather we know in 2007, there was a substantial change. It became much more high level, to the extent that you've just said some areas have literally one page of what the curriculum is, so high level there isn't the detail in behind. Would that be a correct summation?
Yeah, there's plenty of cracks for important pieces to slip through.
Massively. So, I mean, from your research, did you get some insights of what the catalyst was? Why is it that there was a change?
Yeah.
Was it seen as that it was too structured, and this is the classic pendulum swung out to now so laissez-faire that anything goes?
Yeah, it was somewhat of a pendulum swing. And New Zealand, unsurprisingly, was behind other countries in rolling this out. So France in the 1990s introduced a curriculum that was similar to this in that it was very sparse on detail. They U-turned years ago. So that had been tried. And the philosophy was evident in the 1970s. Found this really interesting. There's an educational researcher from the UK named Michael F.D. Young. He's been quite influential. Going back to the 70s, he and some of his colleagues were looking into the reasons why working class students were so far behind other students. This is in the UK. And their theory, which to their credit they tested out before actually doing anything, was that the reason is there was this foreign curriculum that was being imposed on them, and that if they had a localized curriculum that was, they were more familiar with the contents, they would do better. Well, they were surprised to find that the localized curriculum designed specifically for them did nothing to improve their achievement. He classified it a well-intentioned mistake, assuming that this would improve things. And the conclusion he reached was that a more equitable education for these students was about not treating all knowledge equally, because the place of knowledge is a big part of the philosophy here. What is knowledge? He came to see that all knowledge isn't equal. It's making sure that all pupils had equal access to the same curriculum, and that curriculum needed to have embedded in it what he calls powerful knowledge. And I think of powerful knowledge as those light bulb moments that we all have in different areas where you get a puzzle piece that makes sense of a whole lot of other things. And if you're missing those key bits of knowledge, I mean, think back to, you know, the early days of school, learning addition and multiplication and how letters sound, like all of those things are useful across the board in everything else you learn, and you build on those things. Now, if you pull a few rungs out of the ladder because you don't think they're important, some students aren't going to make the leap to the next rung. So that philosophy was disproven by one of its original proponents in the 1970s. And yet, decades later, you still have education systems around the world. We aren't the only ones deciding that maybe we should focus on student-centered learning, see what students are interested in. And I actually have seen knowledge spoken of as, I'm quoting here, a process that develops to be replaced, not stored. And so you're teaching information based on what's relevant to the student, not what's relevant to the world that that student is entering.
Well, doesn't that in some ways To me, that reflects sort of the modern zeitgeist that is actually very self-focused. Yeah. And dare I go this far, sort of the narcissism, I would argue, that we see a lot of these days of what I think, feel, believe has to be affirmed by everyone. Yeah. And in an education space, by the way, feel very free to disagree, but in an education space, the idea that the child's going to lead itself into the knowledge that it wants to seems a little bit too too reflective of that modern mindset. I mean, fundamentally, how does a child or how is a child meant to know what it is or is not wanting to learn without having the tools that you talked about, the rungs of the ladder set for them? So it seems all a bit around the wrong way, this child-centered learning, because that's been one of the big phrases of the last 20 or so years. It can't be 20 years. My math is terrible. I had a good teacher, but my math is terrible. So 15 or so years.
Yeah, that it's been floating about at least that long. Yeah.
But still prevalent now. I still hear it as I go, former life would go into the schools. Yeah, we want the child-centered learning. And if I might, one of it is, again, seems a bit too self-indulgent to the person who needs to learn, the idea of being able to impart information. I would make the argument, by the way, says me to you, there's information around us all the time. In fact, in this modern world, particularly with the internet, we drown in information, but we don't necessarily have knowledge. I'd always make that distinction, which is why we want teachers to help, I would suggest, impart information and guide the process towards knowledge. But this must cause massive, massive headaches for the teachers. If you're like my wife, who's got, I think, 26, 27 students, or used to have up like 32, if 32 students are going off on their own individual child-led tangents, that's going to stress the teachers out terribly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the requirements for teachers on paper are impossible. They can't do what's asked of them. And the problem with having such a sparse curriculum is that it requires them to develop a lot of their own material or go find it. There is a really excellent report that Dr. Nina Hood put out last year based on a large survey of teachers in New Zealand. And that put numbers to it. She found that 76% of those who responded are responsible for their own instructional materials. And a teacher, an academic friend of mine, described that as reinventing the wheel by candlelight. They're just all doing the same thing over and over, instead of relying on, expertise that can be shared around and then contextualizing it in the gaps so that you've got, most of what is necessary, what is essential knowledge sorted. And then you can spend your time making things more individualized for students instead of spending all your time. Well, what she found was that I think it was about a quarter of them spend 6 or more hours a week developing materials. That's not necessary. You can have good teaching and good teachers without that extra workload, but that's what this curriculum has put teachers in that situation. Now, the other problem with that, as I mentioned before, is that not all teachers are gonna come up with the same quality materials. So you've got people literally getting stuff off social media. It doesn't mean it isn't good just because it comes off social media, but that gives you an idea of the variation in what's being taught. And the other problem is it's not guaranteed that if a child switches schools, they'll be on the same page between schools or even between classrooms in the same school. So her report just highlights how this has led to way too much variation. And New Zealand has about the largest gap between high-performing and low-performing students in the English-speaking world. This probably isn't the only reason, but it's a big reason why it's not equitable.
A load of really important things to draw out there. We might start almost chronologically. So you mentioned Dr. Nina Hood. So she heads up, is it the Education Hub? She's been a teacher herself. So for listeners to understand, a very respected researcher, academic in this space. And I think it's one of the, says me to you, Marianne, one of the key reasons why she's quoted. And that quota of work for teachers is phenomenal. So quite a few teachers in my wider family. And then living in New Zealand, we all know teachers. Yeah. They always are talking about the massive, massive workloads. And so starting on that curriculum side, it's because basically, I'm using your term again now, to reinvent the wheel. So they're given a page on maths or a page on English, high level, excuse my slightly derogatory, but fluffy concepts, and they've got to try and actualize it in reality and for each student. So, yeah, they are literally trying to create content each and every night for every school day. It's just, what did you say again? It was like 6 hours a week.
A quarter of them are spending six or more. I don't know what the average is, but the majority are spending four or more hours.
So you're talking about 15% of I was going to say 15% of a standard working week, but I'll put the rider out there really, really quickly to people that basically very few of us work fewer than 40 hours. So I better not perjure myself there. But that's a phenomenal amount of time they're doing to produce content because they're not meant to be on textbooks. But if I might, the paradox strikes me, having been around enough teachers now or having gone into classrooms, they're just downloading or accessing a lot of material from social media, from YouTube. I know there's a website, Twinkle, which is incredibly popular. So we've thrown textbooks as a country out the window. We say that everyone's just to go and create their own. But what we really know, I think, is most teachers are going to set sites, understandably, to try and draw content to create almost their own individual textbooks, which are just the same as everybody else's anyway, because they're all on the same website.
Mm. And you've got many of them saying that they don't think they've got access to high-quality material. The highest quality in the survey was the material that teachers produce themselves. They rank their own material higher than anything. Ministry of Education material was the second least popular next to social media as far as...
The second least popular, as
far as being seen as good material. So they're not well supported. The look into the curriculum gave me a bigger appreciation for what teachers are actually having to deal with, because the expectations have been raised that they will make education, more kind of custom to just specific needs. And there's a big focus on that, which would be fine if they were freed up to have the time to do that. But actually, they've got a greater burden than they had before 2007, when they had a more structured curriculum. And this isn't just, oh, it's harder. If you look at international research, there's a correlation between knowledge-rich curricula and both more equitable and better student outcomes. So it's not just that it doesn't sound like it won't work. There's evidence internationally in countries that have switched to more content-rich. They've done the U-turn and their student results have improved.
Well, let's draw that out. I want to come back to the whole knowledge-rich element, because personally, and it's the philosopher in me, is worried about sort of this relativism in modern society, that there's no real truth. You know, quid est veritas? What is truth? So, you know, we couldn't possibly impart my view of the world or my view of science and maths onto a student. They must explore themselves. That sort of mindset, I think, is in operation. But let's come back to that. Mm-hmm. What you've touched on a few times here is the nature of New Zealand's rather light curriculum compared to the curricula. So good Latin declensions coming out here, by the way. In other countries that have gone for the knowledge rich, they're getting better results. So from your research and what you and Dr. Hood and others have seen, is basically New Zealand has slid in or has continued to slide in terms of its rankings across almost all areas, or is it only in particular spaces?
The OECD does every few years international surveys, like PISA is one of them. And all of those international rankings, New Zealand is either treading water or slipping behind. So we're not doing anything particularly well, according to international rankings.
And I have to say, it's been across many years. So in my time in Parliament, been on the blue team, then the red team were in control, and now the blue team are back. But the results are the same. I just wanted to stress that to listeners, that it's not a particularly, from my side at least, a political point. But
I was going to say, on the political side, it's interesting that people from all ends of the spectrum agree that the curriculum is not fit for purpose. And so it has been undergoing a review, which had kind of a start, and I think it's, I don't know, stopping at the moment while the current government figures out what they're going to do with it, because it's been undeniably unpopular. The question is it going to be more of the same? Are they going to repackage the same strategies and philosophies, or are they going to have a look at evidence and try to fit that evidence into a New Zealand context? And I don't know what's going to happen yet.
Yeah, I don't have a deep insight yet either. Unfortunately, I worry from my side, Marianne, sort of an ideological capture, particularly within the ministry. Again, these are just my thoughts and observations that we'll want to hold on, because that's been evident to me for years now. As you say, we have lamented year after year about the sliding results of our young ones, and yet there's been no change. And so I do worry about it, but I mean, this is why your research is so vitally important. It's drawing out strong, clear evidence. It's just not working. And so, I mean, are there some countries then in comparison that we could look to? You mentioned France has done a U-turn, but are there other countries within, particularly the OECD, you go, right, we should look at them, that knowledge-rich content, enabling teachers to confidently source that information and then impart it in their own ways? Yeah, other countries we should look at?
I haven't personally looked into the content of other countries' curricula. Like I said, I'm not a teacher by trade, so that's another world to me. But I have heard New Zealand teachers, in fact, in Nina Hood's survey, some of them are saying they're looking at the Australian curriculum because obviously it's similar to what ours is or should be, and they're finding far more content, far more direction in what Australia is using. The UK is in a U-turn. South Africa has done a U-turn. I've heard good things about education in Canada, but haven't looked deeply into what they're doing. So at this point, from what I've read, it seems like most countries, Estonia was one that Nina mentioned, that the curriculum changed and their student scores have improved. So pretty much anywhere you look, it seems to be heading in the right direction compared to where we are, unless indeed the curriculum review ends up with an actual change in course.
Well, I hope it does, because, I mean, again, year after year, we've seen poor results.
Teachers are leaving. It's hurting in every way possible, because you've got fewer teachers willing to take on that extra work.
Oh, when I used to visit the schools, I would visit every school in my electorate at least once a year and talk obviously to the principal, often to the staff. I doubt it will surprise you. It was the amount of stress they were under. And to put it rather crudely, it wasn't simply about money. Like, everyone wants to be paid more. Let's be clear about that.
Yeah.
But a number of teachers said, look, you know, we just want time. And you've touched on that a few times. They're like, we're just so time poor with everything we're expected to do. And as you, I think, critically touched on, the teacher here in New Zealand has been asked to create their own content for every topic. And there was some research granted in the primary school space more than secondary, but it noted a lot of our teachers coming out of training they themselves haven't passed NCEA level one maths or science. Half had failed English. And you're going, oh my God. And I'm not trying to throw stones at teachers. Any teachers listening, I'm not coming for you. It's just an observation of what's happening. But if they are not passing the likes of maths and science or have a very limited understanding, how is it possible that they could teach or create and teach?
Exactly. And we've got teachers in the classroom now who were taught by teachers under the current curriculum, if that makes sense. So we've got this downward spiral. If you're taught by somebody who doesn't like maths and didn't really get their heads around the first few rungs, what are the odds that you're actually going to be able to get your head around the stuff you need to progress? It's just hurting everything down the line.
Oh, to me, it's mind-boggling. I do worry at the level of excuses or the array of excuses which are deployed into this space. It doesn't matter if it's from politicians or unions or otherwise. Again, it's a fundamental point. You can't teach what you don't understand.
No.
Or at the very least, I would argue you can't create resources to teach others if you yourself don't understand. It'd be like putting me in front of a Spanish class. It would be no good. But I imagine, too, we're seeing much higher disparity. So we already know in New Zealand that there are disparities, particularly across socioeconomic groups, cultural groups. So if we're seeing a decline overall in New Zealand, would I be right in thinking the impact is even higher, say, on our Māori and Pacifica communities?
Yeah, well, that's what I was touching on with this gap between the high achieving and the low achieving, is the bottom percentages are doing far worse. It's not just that everybody's sliding a little bit. It's when you take out a few of the lower rungs of knowledge, those who aren't kind of absorbing it in whatever communities they're in, those gaps just get gappier, you know? It exacerbates itself, because if you don't have fundamental knowledge, then you're going to have a whole lot of trouble adding onto that, because you need foundations.
So it sort of brings me back to, because you've used the word knowledge, you've used foundations. Do we have trying to find the right words here, Marianne, sort of a philosophical deficiency in this country, from your observations, that somehow doesn't believe there are foundations that we can agree on, or knowledge that we can agree on? Is there some sort of, deficiency there?
Yeah, when you were talking about, well, you said you're a bit skeptical of there being change. There are people who are, and it's like a religious fervor, their commitment to, you know, whether you call it student-centered learning or however you describe it, it sounds good, you know, that the things that you're trying to achieve are all excellent things. And the argument against changing anything is that you don't want it to be overly prescribed. You don't want to be drilling kids in things that they're not interested in. They can't be bored. You know, there's this very black and white. It's either going to be student-centered, or it's going to be, you know, mind-numbingly boring. And they're just going to, well, we have got high truancy rates now with a student-centered approach. And in the words of Michael F. D. Young, pupils don't come to school to learn what they already know. You're going to have to at some point have directed instruction. And just because you do, just because you have a prescribed curriculum, doesn't mean that you can't focus on what students are interested in. A good teacher will get students excited about a subject within the framework of a good structure. So there's either or. They're very loath to let go of this curriculum. And I've met people, I've heard them talk about how proud they are of it, but I haven't heard them explain what needs to be done to help with the deficits. The deficits are clear, and they just continue clinging on to what they're proud of, which is good sounding ideals, really. It's not any evidence.
Oh, that's one of the things I found, not only in this space, but across many, that great phrases, highfalutin statements, broad appeals, which all sound lovely, but when someone is pushed, there's little evidence to back it up. And often, if I might, there's calls for more money. Well, the solution is just more money, where I look at it and go, again, to teachers, you should be paid more. You well deserve it. Yeah. But I don't think it's going to make any difference when you said the poor teachers are running about every night trying to create new content. And I just sort of wanting to keep reinforcing that to our listeners, to understand that's what the New Zealand curriculum at the moment requires, is for teachers to basically take the high-end ideals or values of the curriculum and then to create their own content, which is incredibly stressful. And I imagine, too, it takes away from some of the energy that they would be able to deploy in the classroom.
Exactly.
Fundamentally, yeah.
Yeah. You can't spread them too thin and then expect everything to go marvelously.
What I'm finding too, in some of the schools I've dealt with, they do a lot online now. So not only is the teacher looking at, say, the science curriculum that says learn about, no, I'm not even sure, the universe. So they've got to go out and source all this material, but they've then got to translate it, if you will, from paper or whatever they source in, onto an online system. It's another level of bureaucracy. And I'm not arguing against the online learning, but it's just another step, another administrative requirement on top of everything else that they're doing.
Well, that's the kind of inevitable effect of being run by a ministry or bureaucracy. I mean, things only ever get more complicated, not less. So That's a whole nother conversation.
I could see that. Well, worryingly too, though, you mentioned earlier that the ministry's materials, excuse the alliteration, the materials of the ministry are the second least liked. People going elsewhere. So we've got a whole pile of people creating materials that no one wants to use. So, I mean, even that's a sick signal. Yeah. Just a couple of other points. Again, this child-centered learning, surely the evidence is overwhelming that, well, I'm going to quote King Lear because I love Lear, the play that is, but the fool in Lear says nothing will come of nothing. And when I think of that in learning, if a child's meant to look to lead its own learning, if it doesn't know the basics, if it doesn't have the rungs, as you keep using analogously, how on earth is anything going to come of that? I mean, is there genuinely a pedagogy out there that believes every human being has all the knowledge deep within them from birth and they just has to coach it out? Is that the mindset in some of these educators?
It does seem to be so, and the idea that there are knowledges is out there, it's just incredibly relative. And we know, living in a physical world, that there are some facts. Things are true and not true. And finding out which are and which aren't is actually really important to navigating life well. So it's incredibly disconnected from our day-to-day experiences, but it persists.
I just find it mind-boggling. I think it's what I was touching on somewhat obliquely at the start. It's sort of, there's this funny philosophy out there at the moment. You've used the term knowledges. Mm. I've often talked about people who think there's multiple truths rather than actually there's some observable realities, which is why drilling young people in their times tables is worth it. It's mind-numbingly boring. I hated it at school, but actually it was that knowledge base. I hope I'm using the right terms, but it was a knowledge base imparted, drilled, not literally, but, you know, beaten into me that enabled me to develop, whereas the current system seems, well, can't even seem to agree in some sectors. I was shocked to even understand that math has an element of truth. We're getting a whole lot now of discussion, well, there's like New Zealand math, there's Western math. It's like, what? That makes no sense to me whatsoever.
I'm pretty sure that mathematicians don't see it that way, people who've studied it as a science. And the funny thing is, there's this emphasis on critical thinking, on encouraging critical thinking. But if you don't have the facts straight, how on earth are you supposed to think critically about something? You will be thinking emotively, not critically.
Well, it's one of the things which drives me mad amongst many, is the use of terminology. And you've just touched on one of them that our the ministry and others use a lot, which is, students will be taught critical thinking. And when I first heard this years ago, and as I say, as a student of philosophy, I went, oh, that's fantastic. But it soon imparted that actually it's not critical thinking in the way most of us would ponder it or perceive it, rather. It's got a whole, well, there's no foundation.
No, there's it ends no up foundation. Teaching you what to think and not how to think, because to teach someone how to think, you have to give them a really great selection of knowledge to build on. And if you don't direct somebody's learning in a certain way and give them that information that, like you said, they're not born with. You know, we're not born knowing about the Russian Revolution or about mathematical theories. You know, all of those things have to be learned. And I think this ties in with how teachers are valued as well, because I kept hearing the phrase, teaching isn't valued enough. And so I went digging in that area, like, what would it mean to be valued and why are they not valued enough? And I think part of it comes back to what we see and what even some teachers see as the role of teachers. And if they're just there to guide someone along in what their, you know, their own private pathway, you know, just to kind of encourage them on their way, that is a completely different role to being somebody who can direct learning, who knows where the student needs to go to, you know, as Michael F. DeYoung speaks about, that powerful knowledge. You want to lead them in the paths of those powerful pieces of knowledge that they need. That person is far more important than, well, the teaching council standards for teaching. I remember reading them and thinking that is pretty much what you'd want in a good babysitter. You know, a nice person who is encouraging and treats everyone equally and, you know, all lovely things, but there's really nothing in there about teaching. So of course you're not going to value a teacher well if they're not actually seen as teaching.
Well, Sandy, look, this will be too much of a tangent with the time we've got left, but we're seeing work come out of the likes of Jonathan Haidt and others, which are actually talking teachers are more people there to manage emotions and the feelings of students and their well-being. In fact, that is a big problem in New Zealand. So much of the curriculum or focus now is on the well-being of the child. And it's like, well, actually, one element of well-being is learning.
Yeah.
But I like what you say. It is, and it's something I hadn't factored or considered, that yes, as teachers as a whole are looking for more respect, well, rather, respect used to be based on having that knowledge, those skills to impart. But if you're on a more relativistic trend, which we seem to be in New Zealand, that really there is no truth, or you just make it up from your own experiences, then what is the role of a teacher? Why are you needed? And in fact, unfortunately, I've seen some, I'm not sure you'd call it research, but some, it's only anecdotal work, that often the high-performing schools, it really is because the students are coming in with great support through families already, and that the teacher's input is not as efficacious as it might be, which is unfortunate.
Well, and the interesting thing, looking at schools who work in like low socioeconomic areas, where students aren't coming in with advantages, you know, their parents might not have been in higher education, there are schools that are succeeding in those areas, and they are doing what we're talking about. They have expectations of students. They are good at managing behavior. They are helping them through the challenging things instead of removing anything challenging, so they, you know, won't suffer anxiety and stuff like that. So it is possible in any community to have a school where students are succeeding. It comes back to what you see the role of a teacher as, and what you expect your students should be doing as students.
Well, I did a record for another station a couple of months back with, of all things, my brother-in-law, who's also a teacher. The whole Bridges clan, from my wife to brother's mother, they're all these teachers and ex-teachers. But he was saying that in his school, in recent years, they've encouraged, if not enforced, 20 minutes of reading at home a night, and he has seen education levels almost across the board increase. So you're going back to, I know it's a trite phrase, I apologize, but going back to basics, but that makes a difference.
And involving parents, making it normal to do stuff like that at home, because not all homes, that's normal. If that's introduced and it becomes normal, that can make a huge difference.
But that's exactly the tangential line that we went down as well, not just the educative benefits, but actually if you're sitting there with mom or dad or both, there's actually good relational elements too.
Yeah.
So obviously we've talked around the array of problems. We've even gone down the philosophical line, which I want to do, around sort of your relativism and everyone sort of self-absorbed, therefore how can anyone else teach me? But what are you seeing as what are some of the solutions moving forward? Obviously, a rewrite of a curriculum that's knowledge rich, but what would be some of the other encouragements you would have to the likes of the ministry or political leaders of today?
There are some noises in the right direction, I think, as far as revising the curriculum. It all depends on who is actually going to end up doing it, and if they can actually accomplish what they want to. I don't know, you know, if I was Erica Stanford, I don't actually know what she needs to put in place to ensure that happens. That's a huge conversation. The curriculum does need to be more content rich. That will introduce some controversial elements because, you know, if you're talking about, say, history, not everyone's going to agree about what should be in there. So that isn't going to be without controversy itself. I think for most subjects, it should be fairly straightforward. For those areas where it's not, I think that is just more evidence that there needs to be better educational choice for parents. And that's a whole other topic, but in New Zealand, only about 4% of students go to independently operated schools. Most are in schools that are either state or state integrated. They have to use this curriculum. They're locked into the collective pay agreements. And that just means that when it comes to curricula, parents who, you know, it could be that the student has a certain area that they're interested in. They could be interested in a philosophy of teaching that they think is particularly good for their child. The options are really only available to people who have money, to be frank. If you can afford to live in a good zone, or a zone that has, you know, girls or boys school, if you can afford private tuition or private school tuition, then you've got some options. The vast majority of New Zealanders don't have options. And I think that is part of the problem, because there's going to be no national curriculum that makes everybody happy. That's just not going to happen.
Definitely a conversation, a much, much deeper conversation for another time. But if I could just, if we could just touch on it quickly, because I think New Zealand, and look, please factor in my political bias on this, because certainly in my time in Parliament, what I saw was a move for really to have one state system, anything to reduce the choice. Now, again, that might reflect my politics, Marianne, but obviously removal of the likes of charter schools, no integrated schools, all of our faith schools under enormous pressures. There was a desire to have just state education, and Chris Hipkins and others would often talk about being able, everyone be able to find a place, where it was just, I can say it even as a step parent, anecdotally, that's just not the way it works. And
internationally, that's not the way it's working. The UK now, more than 50% of students go to independently operated, publicly funded schools.
In Say it again?
More than half of students are now at schools that are independently operated and publicly funded. Free schools and academies, which are 15 or so years old. In the States, charter schools have faced a lot of resistance, as they do here from teachers' unions. But there's still about 7% of students who are attending charter schools. They're all pretty much oversubscribed. You need lotteries to get in. So the supply isn't there, the demand is, but there are some alternatives. In Australia, state and national governments contribute to the tuition fees at both Catholic schools and independent schools, which means you've got a significant proportion of your students attending those, because far more families can afford it when they're not paying the full WAC. So internationally, that's the direction it's going. OECD research, it was as far back as 2012, more than half of OECD countries were contributing more than half of private school funding. So we are an outlier. Only Mexico contributes less to independently operated schools than New Zealand. That's where we're at.
Gosh, I hadn't fully appreciated it. I mean, I'm very much for choice. I don't see a problem with a diversity. And I'm not just thinking of private schools or integrated schools as we think about them here, but, you know, even when I look at the, if you will, the special schools, Montessori and others, there's just such a need. And it, again, says me, the layman, noticing how many parents are making a choice to get their children out of state school. So either homeschooling now or searching out at the International Baccalaureate. But understandably, but I think sadly, that's only an option for people with money.
Or time, which equates to money.
Absolutely.
It's very, very few families can actually do that. And a lot would love to go to state integrated schools. I've got a friend who is the principal of one. They always have a wait list, and it's been growing.
And well, I suppose that's an example of where excellence shines out, and parents want that. And I found that across, used to argue with some people, think of the grumpy bums of people who would disparage those who are less fortunate than them, and would, you know, blame poor educational outcomes on low socioeconomic groups. And I'd always argue back going, no, every parent by and large wants the best for their child. Every parent is looking for choices, but the way New Zealand's structured, you've got to go to the state school that you're right next to. And some are brilliant, many are, but some very much lacking.
The bottom 30% of high schools, I think only 2% get UE. I mean, what are your odds if you go to one of those schools?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's
not equitable at all.
No. And maybe I should wrap it up here. This is where the paradoxes I find come into this space so often, that actually what's being said or promoted is often not actually being reflected in reality. So people talk about New Zealand's world-class curriculum, but as we've discussed, it's not working.
Yeah.
Our skilled teachers, well, they are, but they're stretched often beyond capacity. And then you will often hear the discussion of choice. No, all these state schools have all the choices within them. It's like, no, they don't. They don't at all.
Now, special education, that's a whole other topic. But special education students are extremely poorly served.
Oh, terribly so. We've got a number of friends of mine who have children, young people who need that support. And that is a whole nother discussion for another
time. It's about more than just money, yeah.
It is. Well, no, but now, yeah, this is always my soapbox because, yeah, look, if we could, I've said this in the parliament a few times, if all it took to solve the problems, education or in healthcare or crime, was money, would have done it years ago.
Yeah.
That's the simple way out. Now, again, that's not to say people shouldn't be paid more, but that's another whole discussion as well. Marianne, I am so grateful for actually even more time than I had suggested to you originally
you,
to talk through. Yeah, can I encourage listeners, if they want to jump onto the Maxim Institute's website, so that's maxim.org.nz, and look up Marianne's work. And the report we've been particularly discussing today is entitled Grading Our Curriculum, Failing Students, Teachers, and the Evidence Test. So, Marianne, thank you so much for coming on and talking us through what I think is such a vitally important area, not only for our young people, but for our country.
Thank you so much, Simon.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.